One of the emerging roles in computer science today, thanks in large part to the rise of distributed systems, is that of the chaos engineer, an engineer whose whole job is to break things in fun and interesting ways, but also in systematic and well thought out ways, all to make our large scale applications much more resilient. Today's guest, Mikolai Polakowski, is a practicing site reliability engineer and also the author of the book, Chaos Engineering, Crash Test Your Applications, from Manning Publications. But of course, his career didn't start as a chaos engineer. Mikolai has held a variety of roles in software after getting a bachelor's and master's in computer science. He has held roles ranging from IT support to iOS developer to software engineer, director, CTO, and these days, project lead. Along the way, he's worked for the likes of Bloomberg, Cozy Cloud, Bull, and even started his own company, Brainjar. What a fantastic name that is. He is also the creator of the Kubernetes chaos engineering tool, Powerful Seal, and the networking visibility tool, Goldfinger, just like Goldfinger, the James Bond movie. He is also an active member of the chaos engineering community and speaks at numerous conferences. Be sure to stay tuned as we ask this chaos engineer random questions until he breaks.
You're listening to the Developmentor podcast, hosted by Grant Ingersoll. We have one goal on the show, to help you build a successful career in tech, no matter where you're from or where you're going. We do this by showcasing interesting people working across a variety of roles in tech and deep dive into their why. If you want to learn more, please visit our website at developmentor.com or follow us on Twitter at @developmentor.
Cloud computing has changed the way we live, do business, and stay connected. With everyone using the same cloud platforms, winning and losing comes down to having the best talent to build products better and faster. So whether you're an aspiring developer looking to level up, a product manager looking to capitalize on machine learning, or a CTO like me wondering what all the buzz is about for Kubernetes, tech and cloud skills have never been more important. This is why we have teamed up with Cloud Academy here at Developmentor. Cloud Academy brings you thousands of video courses, learning paths, practical hands-on labs in real-world cloud environments, and tools to design to help teams assess, build, and validate critical cloud skills. Most importantly, Cloud Academy stays agile, challenging you with new content, labs, and tons of features that ensure your skills stay relevant and everyone can level up. They cover everything from major certifications to DevOps, security to programming languages. I'm using my free trial time to brush up on my understanding of Kubernetes essentials and serverless principles. Cloud Academy is the cloud training platform of choice for Fortune 500 companies and thousands of tech professionals around the world. Don't just take their word for it, though. Check out their reviews on G2 and get started now at cloudacademy.com. For a limited time, our listeners can lock in 50% off the monthly price for life. Just put in the coupon code MENTOR when checking out. It's a great way to pursue certifications or just build expertise during these uncertain times. Again, go to cloudacademy.com and use the coupon code MENTOR, M-E-N-T-O-R, to lock in 50% off the monthly price.
Hey, Mikolai. Welcome to the show. So great to have you here.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for getting me here.
Yeah, and I think even though you're at Bloomberg these days, and I used to do a lot of work with Bloomberg in the back and actually have been in the London office, I don't think we've ever met before or even know some of the same people, but it's so great to have you on the show here.
Sure. Yeah, it's a big office.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, sometimes it feels really small in tech and other times it feels really big. But, you know, I'd love to get started with really digging in on what inspired you to get into tech in the first place. You know, I mentioned in the lead in there, you started off obviously going to school in computer science. So presumably this was an early fascination. But what really inspired that lead into tech in the first place?
I've kind of been inspired and just kind of in awe of the fact that you can have this piece of silicon and you can actually make it do what you want it to do. And so I guess the entire IT and computing started for me pretty early. That said, I grew up in Poland and the access to that wasn't as great as other countries that had it better, I guess, is a way of saying that. So I only really started doing things maybe at age like 13 or 14. And it was this drive to be able to say, oh, I would like you to do this. And this piece of metal and a piece of silicon actually doing that. And that hasn't changed. That still kind of blows my mind every day, when we write something and it actually does the algorithm. So I've always been interested in that since I remember.
I always love those stories of the very first computer that, was brought home for me. It was, I think, the old AT-80 or whatever, the IBM, the kind of the first public mainstream or one of the first public mainstream IBM. My dad would used to bring it home from work. I'm kind of curious, what was your first system that you worked on there?
Yeah, so the first one that I actually properly worked on, apart from like a public library or something, I was lucky enough that my dad was an architect. And so it was a time of kind of transformational when they moved on to, CAD software instead of just drawing everything by hand. And so one day he brought home this, smoking hot Pentium 166 in this mid-tower. That was probably the first one. So Windows 95 and all the way forward.
And the rest is history, as they say, right? That was a breakthrough. I can remember that, the Pentium was the first time I think like you had mainstream marketing for a CPU. So not to date ourselves here too much, but well, I'm curious then. So you go off, you get your computer science degree, and then you also get a master's. And I think one of the questions we often have on this show, and I see a lot in career forums, is, hey, is a master's worth it? And tell me a little bit about your education experience with computer science. What inspired that go get a master's moment for you?
Okay, well, since you asked, so the story is a little bit convoluted. I didn't do that well at the baccalaureate, and basically all of the access to like the better unis doing computer science wasn't necessarily there for me. That's, just the honest truth. What I did have, a card that I did have to play was the fact that I actually learned French to a level that the high school that I finished was French speaking. So I was bilingual at that stage. And the kind of life hack that I managed to pull was that instead of going to a worse computer science school in Poland, I actually went all the way to the south of France. I landed in Montpellier, and I just started at the uni, a science uni, generalistic degree that would later end up being a computer science one. And then through kind of like internal transfers, because I worked hard, I was able to actually end up in one of the better schools in Grenoble. It's called ONCIMAG. For me, the entire thing was a little bit different because I actually had to, come up with the money to support myself during that time. The thing that made it possible for me was that once I moved to, I spent 2 years in Montpellier and then I moved to Grenoble. And the thing that made it possible for me to actually finance that was the fact that they had this deal called Alternance, which is kind of like an apprenticeship level, really. Which meant that I spent half of my time at the company that employed me and paid me roughly, half of the money that I would get if I was working there full time. And during the other half of my time, I had to cram in all the classes that, you would normally have and all the courses and pass the exams. And, that had the downside that obviously I had no free time. And when people were, kind of traveling around the world during their holidays in summer, I would actually go and work at the company. But that meant that I started working earlier, well, 2 years earlier than I would otherwise. And that also meant that, you know, instead of actually paying for my degree paid for my life during that time and then some. So that's a kind of unusual way of achieving that, but it worked really nicely for me.
Being a university in southern France doesn't sound too bad either, right? Although I imagine like learning a really technical field in a second language, I mean, even though you're kind of high school fluency and perhaps better, I imagine learning a technical field in another language is got to also be pretty difficult.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was a challenge. I think the worst part wasn't necessarily like the computer science, was the, you know, mathematics and mechanics and all the things that I just didn't do in high school and I had to catch up. And I mean, you know, to that extent that I needed to catch up. And the schools, the French system makes the, you know, elite schools pretty competitive. It's kind of like a different system. You know, you don't need $200,000 to go to a good school. But you do need to work like a mad person to be able to get the results that get you there. So yeah, the language was something that I had to work harder than everybody else. But that also meant that, you know, a lot of these abstractions that I was learning, I didn't link them to like the concepts that you get in your primary language. And you kind of have to operate on a little bit higher level. So I think, you know, the extra effort just made me work a bit harder, but worked out pretty nicely in the end.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of thinking about it. I love the connection there for our listeners. I would have never thought that way. Although I do recall when I felt like I learned grammar better when I learned a second language as opposed to in my native language as well. And that actually helped link to later in life through natural language processing and things like that. So I'm curious then, you know, so you mentioned you started working early on as well out of necessity to pay for university. But I'm also curious, you know, in those early days, what was your career mindset when you were getting started? How were you thinking about your career beyond just, hey, I need to pay for classes, I need to pay for my life?
I really just kind of enjoyed learning pretty much everything I could lay my hands on. So when I started working, I used to work for Bull. That used to be like a pretty big company. They used to do the supercomputers. By the time I got there, the supercomputers business wasn't necessarily thriving that much. So I did a bunch of like different things there. And getting to, at that stage, at least in my career, just getting to learn as much as possible and like, you know, the different paradigms, the different languages, the different ways that people run projects and all of that. That was just kind of enough to keep me going. Yeah, I think that hasn't really changed that much either. Like the aspect that I like the most is just learning, really.
Well, and I love that model, especially when you're just coming out of university, is like, and you see this reflected in your resume and your profile, which is, you know, go try a bunch of different things because you don't necessarily know exactly where your fit is. I know I was really fortunate that way as well. You know, I'd really love to hear, you know, in your own words, what have been some of the key inflection points in your career? You know, those moments where you had to decide to make a change or there was a new opportunity in front of you. I'd love to hear about those as well as how did you approach them? Like what went into your thought process in making those changes to grow your career?
There's obviously been a few things like the move to France when I kind of left the life I knew behind and started a new one was a big thing. When I was still in Grenoble, you know, apart from snowboarding on the weekends, my main thing was just trying different things and started different projects. And one of the things that I did do there was get my first taste of a startup. And there was a local accelerator available there. And somehow through that process, I got selected to start a company called Brainjar. And the idea was to kind of try to match the best developers that do things in the open source sphere into good jobs that would, you know, something that I was interested in myself at the time, that would actually be interesting to them in terms of what they do. And that was an interesting learning experience because obviously I didn't know anything really about like business part of it. I really just wanted to create things and this kind of like big data aspect of trying to make sense of all of this commits and all of this projects that people, you know, contribute to kind of understand what is driving them and what is interesting them, and try to automate that was very interesting. Unfortunately, that fell apart because I wasn't very good at the business part of it. And in order for it to survive, we'd have to have some kind of sustainable model. So that was like my first taste of doing startups. And that's something that I actually enjoyed a lot. I guess another big changing point was when I moved to London. So that was after I was done with school and failed a few other projects. I kind of was in a spot where A, I needed an income stream, and B, I actually wanted to discover what the London sphere and economy looks like. I'm not going to say that was the main driver either. The main driver was personal. I met someone special in London, and that's how I kind of moved here. And I've been in London ever since, for the last 6 years.
Nothing like both money and love to motivate change in one's career.
If you are missing live conferences like I am, be sure to check out the new online series of conferences from Manning Publications called Live at Manning. As many of you know, Manning has been a great supporter of the show, offering free books and discounts for our listeners. We've teamed up with them as a media sponsor to spread the word on this new series. These conferences are free to attend, filled with talks from some really great tech experts, and streamed globally via Twitch. No travel needed. Next up in the Live at Manning series is a one-day event focused on women in tech. It is on October 13th, starting at 12 p.m. Eastern. This is your chance to hear from speakers like Cornelia Davis, who you heard here in episode 88, and Emily Robinson, who you heard here in episode 76. Plus, you can learn about topics like algorithmic engineering on large data sets and get the latest on virtual reality. Head over to developmentor.com/womenintech, all one word, all lowercase, to find out more. In case you didn't catch that, there's going to be a link in your show notes. We'll see you there.
Well, and I appreciate the honesty about starting a company. I mean, that's, you know, in many ways, we learn way more about ourselves through the things that don't work than the things that do work. And so recognizing and trying it is often a big part of our story there. So thanks for sharing that. So then these days, you know, you've taken on this new title, relatively new title, and there's a couple of new titles kind of that we're talking about for roles here. You know, one is site reliability engineer. We've had a few SREs on, as they're often called. Charity Majors was on the show earlier. I think we've had maybe one or two others. But I would love for you to spend a moment for our listeners talking about what being a site reliability engineer means to you. And then we'll talk about this notion of chaos engineering, because I know that's a subspecialty, if you will, of SRE work. But take a moment to explain SRE work in your own words, what that role looks like for you and how you approach it.
Yeah, so that's a very good question because, you know, a few years back, everybody started calling themselves SREs, and it's probably a good idea to kind of define what it actually means in my case. I'm responsible for making sure that a distributed platform works in my current role. It's a platform that's based on Kubernetes, and Kubernetes is awesome and amazing. I'm pretty sure that you've had people talk about that beforehand on your show. But the actual work that needs to be done to maintain it long term so that when it breaks, you know that it broke and you know how to, you know, ideally automatically remedy that. The monitoring, the visibility aspect of that, that's kind of my main focus in this role. So I would say that it's probably just kind of trying to apply the same things, the same principles that we do for software engineering as such to the infrastructure level and the kind of platform level where you just want to eliminate as much toil as possible and you want to make things as stable as possible. And then, you know, the aspect of like the service level indicators and objectives that comes into play to kind of drive how you approach these things.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, we have had a number, I think a couple of Kubernetes guests on as well. The one that stands out in my mind is Kelsey Hightower was on, I believe, in episode 15. I mean, and I think for me, one of the interesting things for being a site reliability engineer is like, you know, this notion that failure is all too common, right? Like in the older days, if you will, hang around while grandpa tells the story. But, you know, in the old days, like, you know, you kind of could trust that a single machine was going to be more or less reliable for some period of time. But as these systems scale and you add in thousands of servers, you know, all of a sudden, even if one particular machine stays around for a long time, there's always something breaking. And this idea that, hey, you know, we should just make that part of our normal day. We should expect failures. And in many ways, I think that then led to this notion of chaos engineering, which is a pretty new area of engineering. Take a moment then and define what is chaos engineering and help our listeners think through, like, is this for me? Like, would I want to be a chaos engineer?
Chaos engineering is basically like an extension of what I just mentioned, where it's a practice of designing these experiments, we tend to call them chaos experiments, to just verify that your assumptions about a system, whatever that system might be, in presence of particular type of failure that you know you can reasonably expect, are correct. Do that in order to increase your confidence that that system is going to work well long term and is going to be able to deal with this kind of conditions in production. That's really the gist of it. It's not really rocket science. I mean, it could be rocket science. I don't know what they do at SpaceX, but the core is very simple. The way I see it, it's just like another layer of testing after you've done your unit tests, your integration tests, and stuff like that, to kind of simulate, well, I'm saying simulate, but it's really inject more or less real failure into things and confirm or deny, you know, that it actually works the way that you design it. And like you mentioned, you know, in the blurb at the beginning, it's kind of getting more and more wind in its sails because of this massive distributed systems where you can like physically, you know, see these components just go down because of the fact that you have so many of them. And you could have this perception that, you know, if you had your laptop and it's run for 10 years, that it's basically, you know, going to run forever. But if you have 1,000 laptops, you know, you're going to start them seeing them actually going down. And the way that I see it, it's basically these experiments that confirm your knowledge, and they're usually driven by some kind of business objectives, you know, depending on what is important for a particular system to do.
And as I understand it, sometimes like these tests are actually things you might run in production as well, right? Where, you know, which is normally not a thing, but inducing some amounts of failure in production to make sure that production is resilient. Because it's hard sometimes to test large scale systems just in the abstract, right?
I mean, that's, you know, that's usually something that always comes up in the concept when you're talking about chaos engineering, but you're absolutely right that if you think about that, you can't really ever properly test things in any other environment than production, because the data is going to be slightly different. You know, the patterns of usage will be just slightly different. Hardware might be different. Configuration might diverge. So obviously, you know, we want to minimize the blast radius, the number of things that can be affected by what we do. But in the practice of chaos engineering, it's actually not unheard of, and it's not completely crazy to introduce some of that failure in production systems. And obviously, that's going to depend very wildly depending on what kind of system that is. If that system, you know, streams movies, you know, it might be more valuable for you to potentially trigger some kind of outage for a small percentage of your users that you expose to the test, rather than have this pop up, you know, much further down the line and cause much bigger outage. But there's going to be other applications, you know, where human life is involved, where you will be having completely different approach to that. So it's a spectrum. But yeah, it's a valid point of view. That said, you know, it's also one of those kind of things that I keep repeating every time I speak about this, because if you do type chaos engineering in your Google search, you're probably going to find slogans like, you know, break things randomly in production. And that puts a lot of people off because, you know, it might sound crazy. And also, if this is like the first thing that you do with chaos engineering, I'm probably not going to get good time trying to convince, you know, your managers or run into trouble yourself with that.
Oh, Mikko, you ruin all the fun. We all just want to break production.
I mean, don't worry. You will, regardless.
Yeah, at Wikimedia, we have a t-shirt we give engineers that says, I broke Wikipedia in production, but then I fixed it. So if and when you break the site, you actually get a t-shirt out of it, which I absolutely love. Well, that's a great segue then. And, you know, you wrote this book, Chaos Engineering, Crash Test Applications, your application for Manning Publications. And before we get into the book, I just want to pause here because for our listeners, as you probably heard with other Manning guests that we've had on, we do a giveaway here. So just like the other ones with Jacqueline Nolas and Emily Robinson and a few others, we are going to do the same kind of giveaway, which is the first five people who email us at hello@developmentor.com will receive a free ebook copy of the book. If you don't want to email us, we do also have a Manning affiliate code link, which is poddevmen20, that you can use at checkout to get 40% off of Chaos Engineering and other books from Manning Publications. All right, little promo giveaway there done. Back to the interview. Mikko, like, tell us then a little bit more about this book. You know, who's it for and what will they learn?
The book is for everybody who wants to actually understand how to implement the chaos engineering experiments. And so if you look at the market now, I mean, before my book, there are at least two other books that explain the kind of reasoning why and the kind of theory behind and some of the use cases when it worked out well. But chances are that you are, you know, already seeing the potential benefits that chaos engineering can give you. And then you have a question, okay, so this is great. So how do I actually do that? And typically people go two ways. Either they go with like a ready-made tool that does some magic stuff and they click around and they start seeing results. And that's great. That's a learning curve. But the reality of it is that in order to actually, you know, scientifically implement a lot of these experiments, you have to understand a lot of underlying infrastructure, you know, OS level libraries, a lot of kind of underlying technology that you at least need to understand to the point that you know how it works and how it breaks, right? And this is exactly what this book is about. It basically takes you through a little journey of different stacks. It goes from everything like blocking syscalls on a Linux machine through injecting failure by injecting bytecode into Java, into JVM, whatever runs on it, through things like Docker, Kubernetes, or even things like front-end applications within JavaScript to give you like tools and enough understanding to kind of cut through these different stacks to be able to kind of face the most popular kind of technologies that you're going to be interacting with as a chaos engineer. So my hope is that, you know, from reading that, there'll be at least some sections where you have this aha moment and you understand that, okay, this is actually not that difficult. But in order to be scientific, I need to understand how it works. Yeah, so kind of like a hands-on, you know, all the info that you need to get started with various popular use cases where you would be applying failure.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, and I love, you know, the setup for the book here as well. And first off, I love that notion of a blast radius. I don't know, for some reason, like the game player in me as a kid, it makes it feel like a game a little bit at times, I'm sure. But I love that you have this setup around making it scientific, right? Like, this is not just like somebody coming in and randomly destroying machines or slowing down the network or anything like that. You're being very purposeful about it. And of course, you have to have in place, like I think your chapter three here, are things like observability. You have to have in place the ability to measure the effects that you're taking. So I'm curious, you know, if you can share a little bit more details on what's like a practical experiment somebody might run in their work environment, right? That can start to bring this in without doing perhaps, you know, the blast radius is really small, right? So like, what's a practical one that somebody might get started with as an experiment?
Usually what I recommend for people to get started is kind of like a good balance of a wow factor and actually usability, is to kind of look into what happens when you don't necessarily break things, but you slow them down. So let's say that, for example, this is from chapter 4, I think, database trouble. Let's say that you have a simple setup where you have some kind of server that serves some kind of application, and it's backed by a database. And the question I ask people is, okay, so do you know how much your application would slow down if the connectivity between your application server and your database server slowed down by, on average, let's say 100 milliseconds? And typically people are very wrong about that, because they forget the fact that for a single request, your application might be connecting to the database multiple times or might be making multiple requests. And so this 100 milliseconds is going to be counted many, many times apart. That's like the first step that you can implement very easily. If you're running that in Docker, there's a one liner that you can use to implement something like that. If you're not, you can do it with TC. You know, most of the things that I'm talking about are on Linux. It's a little bit of a different story on Windows if you run that. But in about 15 to 20 minutes, you can actually see like a reasonable use case that you see will be applicable to a vast amount of things, and that costs you only a few minutes to implement and verify. So that's like a readme kind of, you know, getting started that I tend to recommend to people. Or otherwise, if you work on things like Kubernetes or Docker, there's also plenty of examples in the book where it's easy to start. And also, I should mention, if you're scared of this kind of thing, all of the experiments that we do in the book, it comes with a VM that you can start, and it has all the things like pre-configured, pre-installed. So it's really quick to start. Like when I say 15 minutes, I kind of mean it.
Well, and for our listeners, I'll add a little color onto the slowing down the network, because, you know, having worked in the search space for a long time, there's actually been a number of studies that show just slowing down search results can be hugely expensive. And it reminds me of a story I heard, I think, from somebody at Microsoft, and this is public information, or was, that they ran an experiment where they slowed down search results by, I think, 100 milliseconds, like you said. And it had the effect of something to the tune of costing them $150,000 per kind of thing. Right. So effectively a fully loaded software engineer every year, just by the network connection being overall slower in the system. So don't quote me exactly on that, but there are all kinds of these stories of just the cost of especially high performing websites in terms of ad revenue and things like that. So
yeah, exactly. And this is like kind of the beauty of this, that, you know, you get pretty good bang for your buck in terms of return on investment when you do this kind of experiments. And also, this wouldn't be captured by probably any other form of testing. It works. It's correct. But how does it behave when it slows down?
Well, and so then I'm curious, kind of stepping up to the meta level, you know, you've got this full-time job, you're in London, you've built a good home there and a good work-life balance. And then, you know, you throw into the mix of this, hey, I'm going to write a book. You know, tell us a little bit about why write a book. And, you know, because I've written a book, it's a lot of work, but it's also very rewarding. So I'd be curious to hear your take on that step, that leap you had to become an author in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, if I knew how much time it would take, I'm not sure I would actually go and jump into it, to be honest with you. I'm not gonna pretend that was my idea. I was actually approached by the acquisition editor, Mike from Manning, and he kind of talked me into doing that. They saw the powerful SEO and a few conference presentations that I gave on it. Well, basically, his pitch was, you know, it's a small world. There isn't that many people who work in this domain, but we expect this to kind of, you know, become more and more relevant and popular. And hey, please write a book with us. And he convinced me. The rest is history, as they say.
I love it. I will tell you, though, like when you're in the thick of it, yeah, it feels sometimes really hard and difficult. But the reward of seeing it in print or on shelves, or somebody coming up to you and saying, hey, I read your book and I really enjoyed it. That is a really powerful feeling. So I'll just say, hang in there. You'll get through it. It's something you can do. You just got to keep writing every single day or on a regular cadence. So you hinted in there, though, too, you've also kind of made that leap to be a conference speaker. And I'm curious as to, because again, like that's another layer into a career. You know, I often like to think about how do we add different skills that complement and round out our careers? And for many of us, that can be speaking. What inspired that?
That's a very good point. I think that my main drive for it was to kind of force myself into being a little bit more in public. I'm naturally a very introverted person, and you know, most of my thinking is happening inside of the brain. Not that much comes out of my mouth most of the time, but that, I think, helped me back in some respects before. And this conferences business was kind of like a low impact, you know, if they hate it, at least I'm not really talking about anything too personal, you know, they can criticize my work, I can stand that, to kind of like ease myself into this, you know, interacting with people publicly. And, you know, looking back, you know, with the amazing thing that the hindsight is, that was probably one of the best decisions I have ever made, because it really kind of turned it around for me in terms of how I just approach, you know, talking to people, and made life a lot of easier. And then, you know, after I gave a few of these presentations and people didn't hate everything and they didn't call me out on all of my BS, I actually started enjoying that. That's probably one of the aspects why I ended up writing that book and why I ended up doing the other speaking engagements.
That's fantastic. I mean, I think it feels so scary. I remember my first one. I was a nervous wreck. And I'm like, can I really do this? I don't know. So,
yeah, exactly. So it's like, you know, the cold showers in the morning. You kind of do it. At first you do it despite the fact that it doesn't feel great, but then you start appreciating them.
Oh, see, now we're going to have to disagree there, because I tried the cold shower thing, and maybe it was because I grew up in Minnesota. I don't know. I had enough cold. I'm like, I can't do this. There are some benefits to it, for sure. Well, I'm curious, and coming back around, Miko, what's been the most surprising thing about your career today? You know, what would 18-year-old Miko be like, wow, you did that? Is it the speaking? Is it the writing? Is it the chaos?
Yeah, I don't think the 18-year-old Miko would suspect writing a book to begin with. Like, one of the things that, you know, when I think about stuff like that, is that it's kind of like a chain of different events that just make other things possible. And then, you know, when you look at all these other inspiring people who achieved God knows what, it's kind of easy to overlook the fact that they also had like decades of these events that kind of chained up, and some of them by luck, some of them by accident, some of them by hard work, etc., that made, you know, well, the situation that they're in right now possible. And in all of that chain, if anything of this, you know, links went differently, they would be in a different spot. Maybe worse, maybe better. So it's kind of like just looking at it, you know, it's sometimes interesting how it all played out for me so far. Often things that, you know, at the beginning didn't look that interesting or didn't look that exciting ended up having a twist.
I love the taking it a little bit more philosophical, because I think you hit on one of the key things I really see in this show, which is, you know, some people start out with a plan, other people kind of come at it in a bunch of different ways. But, you know, of course, there's sampling bias, and then I'm interviewing people who are still in this career, et cetera. But it kind of just works out, or it can work out, you know, and sometimes you just got to hang in there, and other times you got to be willing to try something different. So I appreciate that very much. Kind of coming to the home stretch, two final questions here for you, Miko, which is, you know, put on your mentoring hat for a moment. And I'd really love to hear, as you reflect back now on your career, what's your best career advice? What do you wish you knew, or what would you like to pass on to, I don't know, your kids or other our listeners in terms of helping them navigate and understand their career?
One of the things that come to mind is that, you know, since I was younger, and an avid reader, I kind of knew that I was supposed to be looking for mentors and kind of try to find them. But then it's actually pretty stressful to actually go and put yourself out there and ask these people. And, you know, it's kind of like a psychological thing. At least it was for me, where I just, you know, had these ideas, or yeah, I could learn this from that person, but I just couldn't get myself to actually go and ask them. And then I started doing that. And I think that was also one of the things that really helped me, just to kind of build relationships with people and be able to learn from them. And sometimes all it takes is just a single email. And if they say no, that's okay too. You know, if they don't feel like it's a good fit, that's probably doing you a favor too, not wasting anyone's time. So just kind of like, if you're reading all of these things, you probably know that you're supposed to be doing that, but just actually taking that action is one of the things that come to mind. And I think the other thing is, just going back to this kind of chain reaction, is that, you know, at no stage in life you can plan things with any kind of certitude, really, and these things change. I think that, like, you know, what makes you the most kind of resilient to the changes and the kind of plot twist that life throws at you is to just try to not be too upset when it doesn't work out the first time and try again. And if you end up on a different link, on a different chain, there's always going to be some kind of different possibilities and opportunities that are worth exploring.
I love it. You know, one might say that you should inject a little chaos engineering into your own life. I suspect, right? That it actually kind of works as a life approach too, of designing these experiments, and it's okay to try something else. Nikolai, thank you so much for being on the show. For our listeners there, again, first five people who email us at hello@developmentor.com are going to get a free ebook copy of Mikolai's book. But for Miko, I'd really love to just hear, where can our listeners best follow you, learn from you, buy your book? What's all the best ways to connect with you?
I think the best way to connect with me is to go to my homepage, which is my first name at mylastname.com. So MikolajPalikowski.com. And you can hit me up on Twitter or LinkedIn or GitHub. If you would like to kind of stay up to date with the chaos engineering stuff, I would invite you to go to chaosengineering.news. So chaosengineering.news. And that's a newsletter that I've put together, in which I'm going to try to regularly update you on all the things chaos engineering, including the updates on my book and any other projects that come with that.
That's fantastic. For our listeners, as always, we will link up all of those things in the show notes, so that if you're out on a run or listening to this in the car, don't worry, we will have them written down for you. Mikolai, so great to have you on. Thank you so much for joining me today.
That was a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Developmentor podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Even better, please leave us a review. If you want to hear older episodes, leave feedback, or sign up to be a guest, please visit us at developmentor.com. If you'd like to support the show, there are three ways you can help out. 1, make a donation via Patreon. 2, if you're a software engineer looking for your next gig and wanting to practice interviewing, use our referral link to the interviewing.io platform. And 3, buy your next tech book from Manning Publications using our affiliate link. All of those links can be found at developmentor.com/support-us. That's SUPPORT-US, all one word. Most importantly, if you like this show, please tell your friends. Referrals are the lifeblood of any podcast. Finally, we here at Developmentor hope that each and every episode helps you move one step closer to finding your path.